This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Threatening Brown, Supreme Court challenges to voluntary school integration with Luke Massey, a national co-chair of By Any Means Necessary, and Shonda Driver, national spokesperson of BAM, By Any Means Necessary.
December 4th is the date set by the U.S. Supreme Court to hear oral arguments in two cases. These could limit the ability of communities to promote diversity and end segregation. In cases from Seattle, Washington, and Louisville, Kentucky, the court would decide whether voluntary integration efforts by these school districts advance the goals of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The court's ruling in these cases have far-reaching implications for the future of the nation's schools. These cases mark the end of the court's longest period without review of K through 12 school desegregation cases since its unanimous 1954 decision of Brown v. Board of Education. The nation's public schools are now more segregated than they were in 1970.
We are joined by Shonda Driver and Luke Massey, and let's start with Shonda.
Thanks so much for having us on.
I wanted to start with, because to me it sets a little bit of the political tone, and that is Proposal 2 in Michigan, which actually sought to and did change the state constitution to effectively eliminate any form of affirmative action, despite the fact there were labor unions and mass groups that were involved in that initiative. Help us understand a little bit more about what happened there.
I think from BAM's standpoint and from the standpoint of the people of Michigan, the loss of affirmative action was something that could have been avoided and something that really, really had to be fought. It could have been avoided because Ward Connerly, who led the fight to end affirmative action in the state of Michigan, used voter fraud as the tactic to get the ballot proposition put forward. BAM exposed that voter fraud. We got the Michigan Civil Rights Commission and a federal district court judge to make clear that there was extensive voter fraud in getting the ballot proposition on the ballot, but still it went forward. And what we've been saying in BAM, and we know to be the case, is that when you give majorities the right to determine minority rights in this society, or to put things more plainly, when you put up for a vote the question of whether there's going to be white privilege or black and Latino equality, then over and over again in the privacy of a voting booth, you see white people vote against their own self-interest. And that's what happened in Michigan. We plan to undo Prop 2. BAM's launched a campaign to do that. We're going to be marching in Ann Arbor on January 15th on Martin Luther King's birthday.
Well, let me slow you down. Let me slow you down because you're moving way ahead. I still want to understand more about Proposal 2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was deceptively known as the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, and it passed with about 58% of the vote, and it makes Michigan the third state in the nation to approve such a ballot initiative in the last decade. So, just going back to that for a moment, how likely is that to stretch well beyond race and ethnicity conscious admission policies to recruitment, to scholarship, or student support programs geared to helping minority students get through colleges and to extend well beyond the Michigan border?
I think what we are seeing is a profound attack on the gains of the civil rights movement. And to be clear, we're not just talking about college admissions or even just college outreach or even admissions, contracting, and employment, all of which now there's a ban on affirmative action programs and policies for in Michigan. What we're talking about is really the resegregation of American society, because affirmative action programs are and have always been anti-discrimination measures that have desegregated not just higher education, but all opportunities in American society, bar the conscious attempts to integrate in America, make them legally infirm, and you bring about the resegregation of this society. The University of Michigan, prior to the initiation of affirmative action programs in the 1960s, had next to no black students at it. In 1965, 1966, the University of Michigan Law School did not have a single Black, Latino, Native American, or Asian American student in attendance. It took the creation of affirmative action programs to integrate higher education, jobs, professions, lawyers, doctors in this society, and it's going to take the maintenance of using conscious measures to bring about integration to stop this society from being quickly propelled back to separate and unequal, a racial caste system that is backed by law.
Now, at the exit polls, there were 56% of the white residents that voted for Proposal 2, while 86% of Black and Hispanic voters cast ballots against it. What does this say about this ballot that, for example, Jennifer Gratz, who had been the chief plaintiff in Gratz v. Bollinger, a lawsuit that persuaded the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a 2003 decision striking down a point-based race-conscious admissions policy at the University of Michigan. What do we understand about it? Because I think it's also helpful to understand the financing and so on relevant to this.
Jennifer Gratz came into the state of Michigan along with Ward Connerly days after we won the Grutter decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. That decision said that it was legally permissible and that it was socially desirable to maintain affirmative action programs and to maintain diversity and integration in education. Jennifer Gratz came back to Michigan and very, very much like the old segregationist after the Brown decision declared that she was going to try to nullify that Supreme Court decision on a state's rights basis. And that's what we're really seeing. It's as though we are seeing the gains of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s being reversed through now a new states' rights effort to overturn federal court decisions and federal policies and programs that have allowed for and, in fact, called for integration to take place in education, in employment, and in contracting. What we're seeing is a state-by-state attempt to nullify the gains of the civil rights movement really through local state efforts. I just want to say one other thing about the Michigan exit polling data that you're talking about. What was so striking about Proposal 2 was that it wasn't possible for the television stations and the radio stations in Michigan to call Prop 2 until well past midnight. Every other race in Michigan, the governor's race, the senator's races, the other four proposals were called as of 9 o'clock at night, because the exit polling data was identical to the raw numbers that were coming in terms of the voter tally. On Prop 2, you had a significant number of white people coming out of the polling booths and saying to pollsters who were asking them how they voted in the exit poll that they had voted to defend affirmative action, that they had voted no on Prop 2. And there was such a disconnect between that exit polling data and how people had really voted that it was impossible for Prop 2 to be called until about 50% of the vote was actually in. And it just says everything about the reluctance, a kind of reluctance and a kind of shame to cast a vote for racism that exists in Michigan. And it's one of the things that I think is very true about the United States. When people are left in an isolated setting to vote on questions of race, so often they vote wrong. When there's a social movement and there are young Black people fighting, standing up, saying we're not going to accept separate and unequal second-class citizenship, when there were, as there were last spring, young Latinos standing up and fighting and saying we're not accepting draconian anti-immigrant rights measures, you really see a transformation for the positive in the society, not just in amongst Black and Latino communities, but also amongst white people as well. And it's part of why BAM is so dedicated to building this new civil rights movement.
Talking about December 4th and putting on those Thursday boots and heading off to Washington, where there are two Supreme Court arguments. Now, aside from talking about what the arguments are about, I'm just still casting this against the fact that, one, almost nobody knows that these two cases are going to be before the Supreme Court, and two, that we just came out with all this hoopla about building a base near the Lincoln Memorial for to commemorate Martin Luther King. Now, against the perhaps hypocrisy of the reality of that, we are about to thoroughly challenge equal protection rights from K to 12. How is this happening? How did we miss this? Why don't people know about this case? And what then is the full impact, potentially, that the court is going to be deciding?
We're really looking at overturning Brown versus Board of Education in these cases and ending all affirmative action programs at every level of education across this nation. Right now, there are 1,000 school districts that have voluntary desegregation programs that are operating. And just to give you one example of one of the two cases, Louisville was a place that was segregated by law, and then when legal segregation was struck down in 1954 in the Brown case, became a city, a district in which there was segregation by practice until 1975, when the court ordered Louisville to integrate, the school district to integrate. In 2000, the court order ended, and the people of Louisville were left with the choice. Do we maintain integration? Do we try to do what we can to break down the barriers that separate us based on residential segregation? Do we continue to have our children go together? And Louisville is a school district that is 66% white, and overwhelmingly, year after year after year, the people of Louisville have voted to maintain their school integration program. They're proud of it. It's meant improvement for every student. It's meant that the kind of intensive educational inequality that accompanies segregated education, there's been a real dent in Louisville, and it's been a great gain for everyone. And what the Supreme Court is contemplating is saying that local communities can't choose to integrate, that school districts, which look at 1,000 factors in making school assignments, can't take into account trying to diversify their schools. And we're not talking about competition for a few seats like we were in the University of Michigan Law School case. We're talking about a mandate of providing public education and school districts having the right to integrate. And we know that if we lose these cases, every magnet school program will end, that we're going to see students next summer being pulled out of schools and sent back to neighborhood schools, and district after district after district being effectively resegregated. And when you think about it, if you can't come up with a legal or a social or political justification for integrating K through 12 education, there is no justification that you're going to come up with for maintaining any kind of equal opportunity or integration program in any facet of American life. So these are cases that are absolutely critical. And what's so amazing, I mean, it is awesome, quite honestly, awesome to be confronted with the fact that we are possibly going to lose Brown versus Board of Education, and that there would be so little publicity, so little public outcry about it, that we wouldn't have every single civil rights leader campaigning on television and on the radio, that we wouldn't have every talk show host, in particular Black and Latino talk show hosts, publicizing these cases and really trying to turn out as many people to the Supreme Court as possible. And it is a reflection of the timidity of too many of the liberals that stand for progress to fight around issues of racism, a kind of pessimism. But it's something that, you know, that people like yourself are you know, contributing to breaking through, and that's just so great.
A lot of people really haven't been thinking about this for a long time. If you could remind the listeners why diversity is such an important thing that should be strived for, I think that would be helpful at this point.
Luke?
Basically, what we would say is this. What Brown said, the fundamental thing that Brown said, that separate can never be equal, is true. That is just a true statement. The idea of Plessy v. Ferguson was just one of the great lies of American history. To say separate but equal was a lie at the beginning, and it's a lie now. And so when we're talking about integration and diversity in education, really what we're getting at is the fight for equality of opportunity in American society. And, of course, it's also true that people of various different racial and ethnic backgrounds can learn a great deal from each other, and the world is an increasingly integrated place. And for the education system in America not to reflect that would be a tremendous disservice to people of all races and students of all races in the country. But the bottom line is the struggle for equality. And the struggle for equality for Black and Latino people in America requires a struggle for integration. There can be no separate but equal. That's simply a racist fiction designed to sweeten the poison of Jim Crow segregation. We're not taking that anymore.
I think there's no question in the minds of the students who are either in integrated or segregated schools that having racial diversity and integration is absolutely a key component of their education, but also their hope for the future. And, you know, we've seen in Los Angeles, we're in a case, BAM is in a case in Los Angeles where we're defending the integration plans of Los Angeles, which are just tremendously popular because they're expressed in terms of magnet schools, and they're popular because Los Angeles is at once the most ethnically and culturally diverse center in human history. There are more languages, there are more people from all over the world who are represented in Los Angeles, and yet it's so wrought with segregation, suspicion, and divides based on ethnicity and race. And for the students, even Black and Latino students, to be able to be educated in the same settings, to have Asian and white students join them, for so many of the students, that offers the possibility of real hope, of real forward motion in the society, of the prospect that we can stand together shoulder to shoulder as brother and sister, as equals and peers, as people. And it is just, I think that there is no doubt in the minds of young people. I'll just say one other thing on this. We're bringing many, many busloads of students from Detroit to the march in Washington. Detroit schools are 90% Black. They are completely segregated, and they are completely unequal to the white schools that are in the suburbs. And more than that, they're coming to Washington because they do not want the restoration of a sense of inferiority to be infecting Black and Latino youth in this society. They want to stand up. They want equality. They want integration.
How do people from the New York area, from the New Jersey area, from the Connecticut area, how do they get on the bus to support this issue?
Look at our website at BAMN, BAM, like BAM, but with a B, by any means necessary, .com, BAM.com. We need people to get in touch with us, so we just ask people, send us a request at BAM.com, letters at BAM.com, and we ask to go on the website, make a donation. So we would really, really urge people to give and give generously, because this is the fight of our lives.
Well, indeed it is, and we will pick this up and find out what happens with the oral argument in the Supreme Court and the demonstration on December 4th. And all you have to do is plug in by any means necessary, and you'll either get Malcolm X, which is perfectly fine, or you will get the organization that has been front and center in defending affirmative action, equal opportunity, and fighting against racism in the court systems, in the legislative arena. And we're sorry that we lost Luke Massey there a few times, but we always appreciate him joining us. And special thanks to Shanta Driver, who's the national spokesperson of BAM, by any means necessary. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
I was born in a little tent, and just like that river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, there is. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come.
Well, we're waiting for that change, and we're going to keep struggling for it to come.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. The Taming of the Democrats. Since the recent Democratic wins in the U.S. House and Senate, there's been a concerted effort from the corporate media to evoke from them pre-installation promises of moderation and a mass denial that there are any plans to impeach a widely unpopular president, George W. Bush. There has been equally aggressive attention paid to House Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi, who makes history as the first American woman to reach what is essentially the third most powerful office in the nation. With few exceptions, most outspoken legislators have poo-pooed the idea of impeaching the president, even before there has been hearings into the events that led to the ruinous disaster in Iraq. Columnists lecture, it would be too divisive. Others decry such talks as radical. What is more radical than war? Why are the same voices and institutions that led the cheerleading squad to war now setting the parameters of acceptable political debate and activity? Perhaps the most influential newspaper in the U.S., the New York Times, used its front pages as a virtual billboard for the Bush administration and high-ranking people like Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of State, then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, quoted the New York Times incessantly in the run-up to the Iraq War. Pulitzer Prize-winning Times reporter Judith Miller essentially served as scribe for the White House. It was press scrutiny that led to the recent downfall of outspoken anti-war figure Congressman John Murtha, Pennsylvania, in the race for House Majority Whip, using grainy tapes from almost three decades ago, the FBI abscam attempts to bust corrupt politicians. It certainly appears like the so-called Washington consensus was unilaterally opposed to Murtha in the Whip post, for it would have provided the critic with a platform that could not be easily ignored. It was precisely this so-called consensus that lined up to support the Iraq adventure virtually without a whisper of dissent. It very well may be the case that these same forces wanted to humble the House Speaker-elect, and yet it was the same alleged consensus driven, to be sure, by the mad neocons in the White House, the Defense Department, and the corporate think tanks that led to this mess. Consensus here in the U.S. is actually the agreement of a fairly narrow slice of the American and sometimes foreign elite. In the brief but brilliant book, Behind the Invasion of Iraq, written by the Mumbai, India-based Research Unit for Political Economy, this theme is argued quite strongly. Typically, apart from legislators and the press, a proliferation of research institutes, semi-government bodies, and academic forums circulate proposals voicing the case of one or the other lobby, leaving the administration free to deny that they constitute official policy. These proposals elicit objections from other interests through similar media. Other powerful countries press their interests directly or indirectly, and the entire discussion, in the light of the strength of the respective interests, helps shape the course of action finally adopted and helps coalesce the various ruling class sections around it. This process, of course, has nothing to do with democratic debate, since the people are excluded as participants and are included only as a factor to be taken into account. We shouldn't haggle with theory here. One need only recall the unprecedented mass pre-war protests all around the nation and abroad. The experts and think tank types decried the ignorance of the masses, but time has proven that the mass demonstrations were right. Now the Democrats, being seduced by the lobbyists, the media, and the know-it-alls, who might best be called the know-nothings, are being persuaded to be bipartisan, to take impeachment off the table, to cool that rap about ending the war. That, like before, is the recipe for disaster, for it ignores the people who turned out to vote largely disgusted with Bush's war. People are sick to the soul about Iraq. If they ignore the public mood, they will once again be digging their political graves. For this war, from beginning to now, has been an unholy disaster, causing the deaths of at least 500,000 people. That ain't impeachable. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.